Would it be true to say South 40 played more out of the Twin Cities?
Absolutely.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Compared to in mm-hmm. the Twin Cities?
Yeah.
So you could say the Twin Cities was Shapiro and Marsh territory?
I think primarily so, yeah. Yeah, pretty much. They had most of the clubs wrapped up. They had the, you know, the Purple Cigars and the Purple Barns and places like that.
Lucky's.
Yeah, most of their groups, the Delcons, were a good example of that. They played everywhere, and I'm sure the Mystics and the Innerbeats and those groups were all...
Let me say, though, that with all this traveling we did in the South 40 band, it kind of helped out later on when we got with the Crow band, when we formed the Crow band, because all we did in that band was travel. So it was a preview of things to come.
When the South 40 played out of town, were the crowds different compared to the local crowds, or pretty much the same, or what did you notice any difference?
I noticed difference because we were... an out-of-town group. We were kind of, you know, people in the small towns in the five-state area, if you're from Minneapolis, you're pretty big stuff because their local groups are not very, I don't know, they probably don't work very much. I can't say this for sure, but they would prepare weeks in advance for a group coming from Minneapolis, and it seemed like it did something for the crowds. They seemed to be bigger.
Okay.
We used to hear the question, are you guys from the cities?
Yeah, mm-hmm. The cities, if you were a cities band.
If you're from the cities, you were cool. Mm-hmm.
Were you opening up for any national bands?
Mm-hmm. South 40 phase?
Well, let's see.
Mitch Ryder?
I'm not so sure.
Mitch Ryder and the Vogues. Remember the Vogues?
Well, that was a rave on.
We opened for Shadows of Night once.
Sure.
From Chicago?
We played with Mitch Ryder a number of times, both in the rave ons and in the South 40. I remember Rochester Auditorium. We opened up for him down there.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And we used to play with, the Shadows of Night. Those groups had those records out back in the mid-late 60s.
Which also did us some good later on because we'd either open or have someone open for us in the Crow Band. And we got to know quite a few different groups across the U.S.
How long did South 40 last?
Well, that's kind of a gray area. I know that somewhere along the line, we started building momentum, and we were involved with this NBOA contest that got us a record deal.
NBOA would be?
National Ballroom Owners Association. And they would nominate their groups to have this big playoff battle of the bands, and the winner would get an audition with Columbia Records. Okay, this happened sometime in late 68 or very mm-hmm. early 69. That we went down, and it out of about 30 or 50 bands, it came down to 10 bands down in Des Moines, Iowa, and it came down to us versus the Flippers. We had beaten everybody except for the Flippers, and we thought it was a done deal. We thought they were going to get it. But we ended up winning that thing, and we went as South 40 to Chicago and recorded four or five songs as a demo, but they rejected the songs. They didn't like them.
Do you remember the songs he recorded there?
Evil Woman, Busy Day, Gonna Leave a Mark. I can't remember the name of the other ones. Maybe it was only three.
And who rejected the songs?
Columbia.
Rejected them.
My opinion is they were looking for another Gary Puckett in the Union Gap, which was real big at the time. We were a little too funky for them. We were a little too edgy.
They were looking for something very commercial.
Right. Right. And it was, you know, that's what their bread and butter was. While we were doing this, a guy named Bob Monaco was in the studio listening, and he picked us up.
What was his background?
He had done Buckinghams.
Chicago.
I don't know if he did Chicago, but he had done a lot of the Crying Shames, the Buckinghams. He had
Aorta.
Done. Yeah, he did Aorta.
Done much production.
He eventually went on he did Diodato, he did Rufus After Us. He did a lot of really, really good stuff. But
so Dunwich Productions was a production company and a booking company
were production management. They did produce records, and they also managed bands.
Okay, so Bob just happened to be there?
Just happened to be there.
At the studio.
Yeah, and he decided to talk to us where Columbia's passed on us. But anyway, getting back to the point was, this was somewhere in late 68 or early 69.
Okay.
So that's when South 40 started thinking about a name change.
Had South 40 been doing Evil Woman?
We wrote it while we were at Planet Casino Royale. So we were South 40. And I imagine we probably were doing it live.
How did that song come about?
Well.
The actual writing of it.
The actual writing of it was, I didn't actually write the words, but it was about an episode that happened to me. It was about a girlfriend that I had once that got pregnant and took me to court and sued me for child support, custody. And it turned into a real ugly scene in court, and I had to have, you know, it was just a long, drawn-out thing and kind of messed with my head. And
well, I remember when we were writing it, Dick. We were doing the instrumental at Casino Royale. We were working on the instrumental.
Yeah.
And Dave was in the front room, and he was writing lyrics. We didn't know he was writing lyrics, but he was writing lyrics at the same time we were working on the instrumental.
Yeah. It just sort of blended together. Dave would write words to, I don't think Dave even had any idea of music. He would just write out like poetry. He would write a story.
But he was writing words about a real situation.
About a real situation.
That happened to you.
Right. He knew about that.
Okay.
Because we were trying to get away from doing other cover material because we were trying to get involved in a record deal. And, of course, you just don't want
to. We were trying to do originals.
Original, yeah. We were trying to shift from being a cover band into an original group.
Okay, so you hook up with Bob Monaco, and what happens?
Well, what happened was, Kink, do you want to tell him, or should I keep talking?
You're doing a good job.
Where did we record that first?
We recorded the demo that we did for Columbia was done at Universal in Chicago. That was upstairs in the second floor in Universal. Okay. That was there was five songs that I remember. Busy Day, Gonna Leave a Mark, Evil Woman, anyway, they had this demo, and he said he wanted to use that, but we had to finish the album. And he was going to use that and put, although we didn't know it at the time, but he had ideas about putting horns on three of those songs. He didn't tell us that. But so we had to go finish the album, which we did.
For who?
Monaco and Dunwich Productions.
They signed you to a
They signed recording? Us to a We signed to them. This is where we started getting into trouble, actually, legally speaking. We kind of shot ourselves in the foot later on, but we signed a deal with them, and we had a guy named Mike Malazgar playing drums with us at this point. Harry had joined TC Atlantic just before this.
Mike
Malazgar. We call him Molasses. Okay, so then they brought, the idea was to bring us to a studio to finish the songs for the album. So they found a cheap studio in Michigan.
Michigan.
Yeah, where was it?
Sparta.
It used to be a movie theater.
Another movie theater, and they had a big pipe organ in this place. Anyway, we got done playing in Virginia or Hibbing, Minnesota, and we drove to Michigan. And I remember driving in the... We did it. We were there for a few days doing the tracks on this, on the rest of our tunes. And then they brought us from there. We didn't finish, but we went back to Universal and did the overdubs. And that's when they decided to put horns on Evil Woman and Gonna Leave a Mark. And I can't remember the name of the other one.
And not bother to ask us or tell us.
They didn't say anything about it. But really, when I think about it, I was kind of ticked at the time, but they didn't even ask it. That's what I was mad about, and I'm sure you guys are pissed about it.
I remember one of those songs that you couldn't remember, the Dada song.
Oh, yeah. 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 No, it's on the first album. Anyway, they brought in these real veteran players from Chicago, you know, and they were just super players. And a guy named Bob Schieff did the horn arrangement, who had done, you know, the Crying Shames, the Bucking Hands, and all the other, who are we to argue with them, you know? And they had the legal right to do it. I wish they would have told us, but they didn't. And it was the right idea in hindsight, because it helped commercial wise.
It's a little shocked the first time we were.
We were pretty
sitting
shocked.
There listening to it though.
All of a sudden we're a horn band, you know. We've never played with horns in our lives, and all of a sudden, you know, now we're like, you know, we're like the Buckinghams or something.
So you've got an album worth of material together,
and they put it out
on what label?
On Amaranth.
Where was Amaranth located?
Los Angeles.
Now, let me back up just a little bit. Here's, again, is where we got into trouble, right? In this stage was where Crow got into problems with, because we had an offer from Atlantic, and we could have gone with Amaranth or we could have gone with Atlantic. And they did ask us, and we told them we'd like to go with Atlantic, obviously. But we were outvoted by Golden. And
by who?
Jim Golden was part of Dunwich. Bill Trout, Jim Golden, and Bob Monaco, that was Dunwich Productions, the three of them.
Three partners.
Now, they probably had their good reasons to do this, because we would have been a big fish in a small pond instead of a small fish in a big pond with Atlantic, and I'm sure that's what they were thinking of. Plus, they probably got a pretty good deal out of the thing anyway, money-wise. They probably, my opinion, I don't know for a fact, but later on, believe me, we paid for it later. So
the album comes out on Amaranth.
On Amaranth, yeah.
And what happens?
Well, we played.
The single took off.
Well, it took off. No, it didn't take off.
The first single was Time to Make a Turn.
Right.
That one didn't take off.
They tried to push that. It did get some airplay, but people in Seattle started playing Evil Woman. And that's where it broke. Off the album.
It was not released as a single yet.
Not right away, but they were playing Evil Woman in Seattle. And all of a sudden, now they're going to, right away, it seemed like within months, they redid the single, and they put Evil Woman out right after that. And then we started going crazy.
And Evil Woman charts on Billboard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it did really well.
17.
Number 17 goes up to? This is 1969.
Yeah, and it went to 14 on Cashbox, and I think it was similar with the other one that was out. Mm-hmm. But see, we were at this point, we were doing nothing but traveling and playing.
Now you've had a switch in drummers too,
and Denny came in to help us finish this album. Halfway through, he left the Castaways. We tried to get him originally, but he didn't want to leave the Castaways, so we got Molasses or Mike. And so, when Denny became available, we got him, and he finished the first album.
So suddenly, in 1969. Crow is a national band with a national hit.
And in that point, when we were recording, we were still South 40, but we changed the name with this mm-hmm. record. And Craswell, I believe, is one that came up with that name.
Crow?
Well, he called it Mother Crow. My recollection is we had a meeting about this, and we were, what should we call it? Mm-hmm. There was a lot of Mother Earth and Mother this,
Mother Lode?
Yeah, those kind of stuff. Why don't we just call it Crow, you know? And
Dave wanted the name of a mean, nasty, funky thing. Crow. Yeah.
He ended up with Crow. And it fit. It somehow fit the music style, so it made sense. So we went with it. And
So now you're playing all over the country?
Now we're starting to play gigs like then we 69 we started doing the Janis Joplin things.
Yeah.
Outdoor music festivals.
At that time they'd already had Woodstock, so it got to be real popular back around then to have these open air concerts, and we started playing quite a few of those.
We were doing a lot of stuff with a lot of people. We played with Neil Diamond, and we played with Three Dog Night, and we played with
Janis Joplin,
Blues Image.
Jim Webb, the writer, songwriter. By the time I get to Phoenix,
we played with Chicago numerous times. Yeah, we played with
Eric Burdon.
We got to know all these guys. Blues Image, it was a good time.
Chuck Berry,
Iron Butterfly.
Played a gig with him once.
The Butterfly.
Were you still based out of Minneapolis, or were?
Well, kind of. We spent a lot of time in Chicago.
We lived there about 6 months at least.
We were
in Chicago. You stayed for 6 months.
But nobody really liked it that much. I mean, because we were on the road, and then we go back, and we were in basically a flop house type environment. It wasn't very comfortable. Uh-huh. And so we all kind of wanted to go back to the roots a little and live here and work out of here, even though our management was in Chicago.
So the first album in 1969 is called Crow Music.
Right.
That's right.
Then it's on to album number two, Crow by Crow. Where was that recorded?
L.A.
It was at TTG Studios.
TTG in Los Angeles?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did
Angel.
That...
Angel Ballister.
Was the...
He was the engineer.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was real helpful.
To my mind, that album captured Crow at probably their peak time, more than any of the other stuff we did.
And that results in two hit singles, Cottage Cheese and Slow Down.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
So the band's continuing to have major success here.
Touring a lot, and yeah.
I think the second two were in his... near as high in the charts.
No, they didn't get as high number wise, but
it was a miniature string of hits. Although, you know, we were on the top 40.
Yeah, so we were top 40 songs, but we weren't number 14 in Cashbox or 17 in Billboard. No, yeah. We were like 32 or 40 or something. But we were getting a lot of concerts. We were doing a lot of playing. We were doing a lot of recording.
What happened when the band came back to the Twin Cities to play live as Crow with national hits? Was it all different? Or
we didn't play here until we played at what was called Uncle Sam's at the time.
Now First Avenue.
Yeah, that was First Avenue. We hadn't played here in maybe a year and a half, maybe. Yeah. We didn't play anything, but when we played that night, we drew 4,500 people in that little bus depot down there.
Was Bob Monaco acting as a record producer also at this time?
Yeah. Okay. Now, he would come up after this point. He would come up, and we'd record at Sound 80.
After this album?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Crow by Crow?
Yeah, we did some stuff at Audio Tech, too.
Actually, it was at Mosaic that he started coming up here more often. And we started spending more time at Sound 80.
At Sound 80.
Who was doing the engineering and producing at Sound 80?
Tom Jonglin's the engineer.
We used Scott. His name was Scott. He did Something in Your Blood. Scott.
Oh.
Can't remember his last name. He was like the B engineer there. Tom was the big guy.
Not Sansby.
No, Scott. Not Fultz.
I can't remember. I can't remember.
We're talking Mosaic now, right?
Yeah, this is after, that's our next excursion. And we did some demos at Mike's Side, they call it at this point. We did demos at Audio Tech and we did demos at Mike's Side. But the stuff we kept was from Sound 80. They changed the name. It went from K-Bank to Universal Audio.
Oh, Universal Audio.
And then at this point in 70, 71, it was Mike's Side.
Hmm. Okay.
And then it turned into... Eventually, it was Cookhouse after that.
Yeah.
But same, all the same studio, though. It was all, they kept changing their gear, but.
Now, there's a couple interesting cover versions of Evil Woman, right, Dave? Do you remember the?
The one we remember the most, and the whole band was there. We happened to play in El Paso, Texas. And was it the agent guy? The booking agent?
For who? I
can't remember his name. Manny.
Oh, Hernandez.
He took us to Juarez.
To where?
Juarez, across the border in Mexico.
Oh.
And we go into a house of ill repute.
Well, it was a bar.
They have a live band playing. And all of a sudden, we're hearing Cottage Cheese.
An Evil Woman, and they were doing
And we're looking at each other going, this is the big time. Yeah. We're sitting in a whorehouse in Juarez, Mexico, and the band is playing our tune.
In Mexican.
In Mexican.
Oh, not, it wasn't your version.
No, it was our version.
It was in Spanish.
It was in Spanish.
A Mexican band had covered Cottage Cheese.
I think what you're getting at is who actually covered Evil Woman, in the whorehouse.
I'm aware of two cover versions of Evil Woman.
That's right. Hmm. There are.
The first one was by...
The first one was by Tina Turner, I believe, put it on her Come Together album.
And I believe she renamed it Evil Man.
Evil Man.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath used it as their first single. And they released it in England only, not here.